Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, and well, what an extraordinary 48 hours in US and indeed global politics. Donald J. Trump is set to become the 47th president of the United States in what has been described as one of the greatest political comebacks of all time. He will carry seven of the seven swing states, it appears. He has won the popular vote, and it's been a complete and utter humiliation for the Democratic Party and its nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris. We're going to break it down here on Put Simply for you. What just happened, and what on earth does the future hold? Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim are my co-hosts. Gents, wonderful to see you both. Rodney, let's start with you. You correctly predicted that Donald Trump would win the election, but did you expect a win of this magnitude?
I just felt like, and I think I probably said this last time, that the polls would underestimate his vote again, and that there's people who won't disclose they're voting for him because it's embarrassing to their friends or their family and so on. But they actually had some sort of sneaking regard, and when they went into the privacy of the voting booth, they would mark for chaos. And that's what's happened. So yeah, I suspected that, you know, if you look at the swing states on the Sun Belt, he was polling 1-odd% up, and he maybe won by 2 points in those states. And then obviously the blue wall wasn't really a wall. So I'm not sure I thought he would carry all the states, but I felt like she had to win those three states where she was polling at a very, very narrow margin in her favor. When in the 2020 election, Biden went in polling much further ahead and just squeaked home. So it's not a dissimilar pattern this time. So it isn't a huge surprise. Obviously, we're now looking forward to who are the appointments he's going to make. What's going to happen about the criminal cases that are he's due to be sentenced on, as well as those that are outstanding? You know, which of the announcements that he made during the campaign is he actually going to follow through on? What are his policies going to be? I know that a lot of people are concerned that he's actually going to do everything that he said he's going to do. I also, from, you know, reviewing commentary and social media and so on, that there's an element of the left who are hoping that he does enact in a literal sense everything that he said during the campaign to really present to the American public how disconnected some of those ideas are. But I don't know whether perhaps just winning in itself was the objective, and he's not 100% sure what he is going to do and what he isn't going to do next. But he'll go into the cycle of appointments. We'll get this whole news feed around that, and then speculation around those individuals and what elements of what he said during the campaign that he might do, and so on. So we're in a whole new phase of pre-transition stuff, not in the sense of the issue that was up at the election, which of course was an issue. On transition, but you know, the transition in terms of the administration, and we just move into that phase. I mean, it is what it is. I know that a lot of Americans are going to be disappointed. I think people more maybe outside America feel that disappointment too, because there's concern about what the impact is elsewhere. But we are where we are. Donald Trump is going to be the 47th president, and let's see what the next steps are in the same way that we do with any incoming administration. Obviously, there's the additional factors of he's got the Senate, the House is likely to go his way, got the Supreme Court. But I don't know how calculating is he in terms of a level of organization to be as, I'm going to say extreme, and I know that's probably a contested description, but, you know, to be as accurate on the policies that he said against what he actually does. Maybe, Ozan, you think that he will do all these things. I still suspect that he probably doesn't remember everything that he committed to do during the campaign, because there were so many different tangents that were explored at different points.
Well, I mean, greetings to you firstly from Philadelphia. Symbolically, I'm looking out my window of my hotel onto the building where the first Congress of the United States was held, and right next to the Liberty Bell. So, quite a meaningful place to be, I think. After this election, I think. To me, it's pretty simple. I think like there's going to be a lot of takes from people who are going to deep dive into the numbers over the next few weeks, etc. I think exit polls are an indication, but of course they're not 100% accurate. I think a lot of that analysis needs to take place. But what you can't get past is that the Democrats massively underperformed. And you know, we can talk about the reasons, and we can talk about what the messaging is, etc. I don't think anybody, including the Republicans, predicted just how bad the Democrats would perform. You know, and it's not just across some of those demographics that you know Trump was able to do better with compared to 2020 on Tuesday. It's across all of the coalition that Biden was able to build to beat Trump in 2020. That coalition did not turn up for Kamala Trump, for Kamala Harris. And to me, that's the bottom line. It's a surprising result. Not that, you know, and we were discussing this that when we talk about who we think is going to win, it was all just theories. So it's not a surprising result in my mind that Donald Trump won. Everything was showing a close race and a toss-up race, etc. But I'm honestly surprised that he won so convincingly, fair and square. And you know, at the end of the day, in a democracy, the people always get it right. And yeah, they in terms of that, they picked the person that they thought would do a better job of fixing the problems that they perceived exist in the United States, whether that's around the economy, immigration, the culture wars, etc. She, I think, just did not have enough time to persuade people otherwise, persuade people of that she's the best person to take it forward. And you know, Trump, with despite all of his problems, his convictions, his character, etc., still managed to bring out most of the people that he brought out in 2020, and that says a lot. And you know, and she didn't. I mean, you can just take a look at New Jersey, for example, which for me, as I said, it's less relevant with which demographics that Trump won out on. He clearly won out on all of the demographics and all of the kind of coalition that Biden had built. In New Jersey, Biden got 2,600 votes to, sorry, 2,600,000 votes in 2020 to Donald Trump's 1.8 million. You know, this time around, Kamala Harris just got over 2 million, and Trump kept his raw numbers at 1.9 million. So a very small change to what he was able to get in terms of support in New Jersey. But because those who voted for Biden last time didn't come out and vote for Kamala Harris, you have a scenario where, you know, he's well and truly, I mean, he's only 5 points ahead when Biden won it with 16 points. And that says a lot in a place like New Jersey. Of course, you've got the Latino element there, and many other elements. But I just think it comes down to, you know, whoever dropped off Biden's coalition, you know, there could have been some swap over. People may have dropped out of Trump's coalition from 2020 and gone on to Kamala Harris's coalition, but they were in much less numbers than those people who didn't turn out, that turned out for Biden in 2020. And you know, I'm sure Trump ate into the support of some of those people who did vote. But I think the important thing here also is that I think that those who were committed to voting either way, particularly for Trump, I think they had made up their mind 6 months ago, if not 12 months ago, and everything else that happened was just noise to them. They had made up their mind that they wanted to punish the current administration, and Kamala Harris, despite running a pretty good campaign for the last 3 months, just did not have enough time to convince those people, and she had to convince those people. So we have a scenario where people, you know, despite their anger with the Trump administration, all of the things that happened January 6th, all of the exit polls showing that democracy was a main concern, typically found that, you know, they were going to continue voting for Trump because in their mind that was the way to save the democracy. And, you know, people on Kamala Harris's side were also voting against Trump to save the democracy. So, you know, when you look at those exit polls and it's 35% was the biggest, democracy was the biggest issue, that's, you know, you can't read into that that they're all people who voted to save democracy for Kamala Harris. It was very clear that both sides had a very different view of what it meant to save democracy. So look, they're my initial thoughts, I think. But anybody who's not shocked by this, I think, is you know, kind of, I mean, this is shocking for the Democrats. But also, you know, I don't think many people thought that the extent of the victory would be this big.
Well, I don't think Trump himself thought it either, right? Because when you have a look at his victory speech on the night, like him just saying, oh my God, look at what we just achieved. And I mean, to me, what's really interesting is, obviously, you know, it looks like he will carry 7 of the 7 battleground states that we discussed on the last podcast, and basically the states that everyone was sort of following on the night. That Iowa poll that showed that Harris had potentially flipped Iowa, she was 3-4 points ahead, you know, showed up to be completely not true on election day. But then you have a look at those swings in some of those really safe Democratic strongholds. You mentioned New Jersey, Ozone. I mean, you look at the outer suburbs of New York City and the swings to Trump. You look at some of the counties in Illinois, Barack Obama's state, and the swings towards Trump. And that, to me, is where that decisive victory is. And it's not just a decisive victory. To me, this is more of a humiliating loss for the Democrats than it is as an outstanding victory for Trump, right? We know Trump and we know Trump supporters, and we know that, to your point, a lot of them had made up their mind long ago. Trump is Trump, and Trump often doesn't surprise because, you know, we kind of know what to expect. To Rodney's earlier point, you know, it felt like 2016, it was a bit of an accidental win in terms of how then he governed a White House. He now knows what he's got walking into, and he knows what he wants to achieve. And as he said on election night, he has a very clear mandate. To me, it's, in terms of the, I want to say the arrogance of the Democrats, because for a long time they were briefing the media that the only person in the entire party that could beat Trump was Biden, because he had done it once before and he will do it again, or he is the only one who has the prospect of doing it again. Now, Biden's demise started in the first year of his presidency. It didn't start at the debate that, you know, effectively ended his political career with Trump. It started a very long time ago. For them to wait this long to then replace him, and then replace him with Harris, who was obviously so tied to Biden that even interviews when she was asked, you know, what would you have done differently? She said, well, I can't think of any policy that or any action that I would do differently. That, to me, is where that level of erring happened in this election campaign. And I really think that played out in people's minds. And to your point of voting against the establishment, of voting against the, you know, the status quo, I guess, in a way, that Harris didn't really, I guess, appeal to people and differentiate herself enough. And then, of course, there's the gender issue. I mean, there's only, you know, Trump's run 3 times. 2 of them was against a woman candidate in the Democrats, and he defeated both of them. The only person who won was the old white guy, right? So I think that still plays out too. America will eventually elect a female president. I think it's inevitable. Clearly, it's not really the time either. Of course, she didn't make gender a big issue as to the point that Hillary Clinton made it. She campaigned on women's rights and the abortion matter in particular. But she didn't do it as much as what Hillary Clinton did in terms of, you know, let's have our first female president. But that was, to me, the outstanding result in that regard, particularly it being called on election night. We spoke about it last time, and Alex Tarasco from Signal, who we had on the podcast, a pollster based in Washington, D.C., said it. It's unlikely that we'll have a result on election night. It was shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern time in the U.S. that Fox News called Pennsylvania for Trump, which effectively then got him to 266, which was 4 electoral college votes off the magic 270 number, and it was all over at that point. But it was, yeah, it was extraordinary in many ways, shapes and forms. Rodney, your views on what this means for the Democrats now, how do they take lessons from what's happened, and how do they move forward as a party?
So I think, first of all, they need to look at this as not an isolated election, but one that's a set of three, 16, 20, and 24. And I think you make the right point that you need to look at Clinton Trump, then Biden Trump, and then you need to look at Harris Trump. And in many ways, Kamala Harris was delivering her candidacy with Biden's campaign and the Biden strategy, which wasn't going to work for her. And that's what's proved to be the case. They went with a blue wall strategy. And if you say, what is the ideal candidate to hoover up those Rust Belt votes that Biden was able to capture, being, connected very strongly to Pennsylvania, right? Who was seen as one of the people, and you're not going to get it with a Californian female, and I'm going to say candidate who just wasn't going to resonate with that voter. So actually, instead of saying Harris underperformed, perhaps it's that Biden overperformed. And when they now look forward, they have to ensure that the candidate, and I don't think it will be a female candidate next time because of 2016 and 2024, the strategy have to be aligned. And that's the campaign strategy as well as, the electoral college strategy, because it was all disconnected in the end this time. She wasn't the blue wall candidate. Obviously, they'll look to the midterms as well, and they'll look to see where they can make gains between now and then to potentially look at other pathways. And then they have to figure out, which governor or whatever might be an emerging candidate with the right age profile to contest against whoever will be Trump's successor, to lead the MAGA movement. It could be Vance, who knows? He's obviously prime position for that. But they need to think through, what the pattern is from 16, 20, 24. If it's the case that Biden overperformed, what are the characteristics of the candidate as well as the campaign strategy against where the opportunities were for them? And unfortunately, maybe America's just not ready for a female president. In the UK, we have a prime minister. We've had female prime ministers, but we don't call the leader the commander in chief. We don't attach this masculine descriptives to someone who's the head of state or the leader of the government. And it just feels like America still has a bit of a blind spot when it comes to getting your head around that a lady can lead as well as a gentleman. And I just, America's maybe not ready. Even if they were ready the next time around, the Democrats won't be, having had their fingers burned twice in 16 and 24, be wanting to pick a female candidate. If they want to go back and try and reestablish the blue wall, they've got a pretty narrow field of potential candidates then to pick from. If they want to look to exploit what they anticipate will be demographic change over the next 4 years in terms of Nevada, Arizona, and then potentially, North Carolina, which was close, or go back to Georgia and so on, well, then they need to think about what candidate and what strategy and what campaign that they need to tie together to pursue those particular opportunities. But it just wasn't laddered up and didn't work well together, and they obviously come off worse because of it. But she also, like, we've touched on this, but she also didn't deal with the economy. It was clearly the biggest issue. It wasn't abortion. She tried to separate herself from the record of Biden's tenure, which is really difficult to do if you're the vice president. And she didn't offer what was the next stage of that economic policy that was starting to get things under control, to at least say, we've done half the job, let us finish it, or whatever it happens to be. And that, again, was just a big gap in what they tried to do and what they ended up achieving. So yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of disappointed Democrats. They had to ditch Biden when they did. They didn't have many options in terms of a replacement in the time frame. She did well, given the circumstances she found herself in. She won back people who were probably unsure whether they'd continue to support the Democrats, but she just didn't have that Biden factor, which was able to counter Trump in those states in the way that he did in 2020. So, yeah, a lot of soul searching will go on. These things are best done sometime after an election, for you guys as well, as you know. Whether you're a candidate or you're organizing an election campaign, it can be a very exhausting and emotionally draining experience. Much more so when you're unsuccessful. And you know, this will be something that they'll take time to reflect on. And the one thing they can't do is be cross at the people who voted for Trump, because that's their feeling, not the electorate's feeling. And it's very easy to go into that type of cycle, which can be very negative. What they have to do is look at ways that they can counter weaknesses in their campaigns and their strategy and their candidacy for the next time round.
I think, I mean, you know, let's wait to see the autopsy in terms of, you know, people's views going into the polling booth, etc. Did, you know, sexism or racism, as some people have suggested, play a role in her loss? Perhaps. But, you know, coming back to what I was saying earlier, I think people had made up their mind a long time ago. And, you know, it's I think whoever the candidate was, we could argue that if they had more time to make their case, they may have done better. But I think it was not. Yeah, I don't. I think it's more of a problem with the Democrat brand rather than the candidate right now at this point in time. If you ask me, I think she was the best candidate that they could put up, in, as you said, Rodney, in a short space of time. There's of course an argument like they should never have been brought to, or they should never have been put in that place. Biden should have left some time ago and allowed for a primary process and a longer time for a candidate to make their case, etc. But you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But I think they really need to review what is their brand. One of the things that the right in the US, if you ask me, have done very effectively, and that's mainly because I think the way that people consume their news in this country, particularly a lot of the people that Trump did really well with, you know, they've really done a good job of making Democrats look like radicals. And I think that in some sense, over time, registered with people. And I don't think they were open to any message from the Democrats. As I said, I think they'd made up their mind. You know, so I don't think that, I think they've got a lot of work to do to get the confidence of people in the suburbs. As Adam mentioned, I think the suburbs didn't come out for her. The women who were supposed to come out didn't come out. In fact, it's very interesting. In a number of states, you saw a very disproportionate support against or for pro-choice ballot measures, but that didn't necessarily transfer across to support for Harris. So
Right.
there is a you can interpret that in the way that yes, women felt like they could have their say on abortion, but then once that issue was kind of sorted out in their minds, they looked on to, okay, now I want to think about the economy and I'm not happy with what the Democrats have done, so I'm going to give this guy a chance, but I've had my say on abortion. So I think, you know, there are a lot of things that I'm sure people who are in the inner circles will go through, and completely agree with you. I think, you know, blaming 70 odd million people for voting for Trump is not constructive. And I think, you know, there are many smart people in the Democratic Party who see that, and I'm sure will factor that in into their kind of autopsy that they do around how they can improve their brand. And I think a lot of it has to do with ensuring that they, I mean, you know, we've seen for some time that the support base for the Democrats have shifted more and more towards college educated, you know, whites, etc. Although they did maintain their support significantly within the black community. Of course, Latinos really did punish them. But, you know, if that's your support base, you've got to figure out, okay, well, how do I reach out to the non-college educated and give them what they are looking for in a leader, in a policy package, in a vision, etc. And they just haven't been able to do that. A lot of it is because there are serious tensions between what those people want to hear in this tough economic times and what the base of the Democratic Party or the new base of the Democratic want to hear. There's, I think, major policy tensions there. But the Democratic Party has to kind of really figure out a balance because they're not going to win elections if they continue to rely on, you know, the suburbs and college-educated whites, etc., who in this case, you know, didn't turn up in the great numbers that they were supposed to turn up in. And that's where you've got to look at it and say, well, even your new base that you've created, you weren't able to energize them. There's something wrong there. You know, I know I'm being Captain Obvious, but there's something wrong there. And what is that that's wrong? And why is such a, you know, significant part of the population viewing you as not fit to run the economy and putting that function and putting that trust in a candidate who I'm sure many people who voted for Trump recognize his faults and flaws, and but they saw him as the lesser of the two evils. So this is, I think, and look, coming back to what we were discussing earlier, and I think Trump will try to do a lot of the things that he said he was going to do. He tried to do them last time. If you remember, he asked the Department of Justice at the time to go after some of his enemies and try to do exactly what he's accused the Biden administration doing against himself. The difference last time was that he didn't surround himself with 100% loyalists. And you can bet your bottom dollar that this time he has nothing but loyalists around him. So I think he will try to do it. Whether he achieves it or not is a different situation. But he's, you know, been very clear that he has a list of vengeances to kind of go after. And I think this is something that is, we can expect it. And there are very few guardrails compared to his first term. And, you know, this should be of concern to many people, I think. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, he's also got a world that's in much bigger trouble than it was in 2016. So it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that, with the Ukraine, with the Middle East, with China. I mean, there are some seriously, seriously big issues that he's got to deal with. And, you know, it's not an ideal world environment or global political environment to take over as the United States presidency, particularly when you've got still quite big domestic issues. You know, he's said he's going to fix it. 71, 72 million people put their trust in him. So let's see if he can fix it. He's given very, very little details about how he's going to fix the economy. But
is he not going to inherit a reasonably competent economy by January, given the moves that the Democrats have made to get inflation under control and things are stabilizing? There is a high level of employment and so on. So other economic indicators are positive. So he might not have to do too much. He might inherit a pretty positive platform, you know, economic platform. It's what he then decides to do on immigration and deportations, what he decides to do on tariffs, what he decides to do on some of the other stuff
And I mean, I think most economists
carries a
suggest
lot of
that.
risk.
I think most economists suggest that tariffs aren't a great idea to boost in your economic economic
Yeah, but I
growth.
mean, but is he persuadable by people giving him advice that he shouldn't do that? Because I mean, he wouldn't have campaigned on that had he not had some
Way up.
idea in his head. Because it wasn't, I mean, he wasn't campaigning on tariffs because the public were saying that's what we need to turn out the economy. That's why we can trust this guy. Was it for the sake of saying something? No, he must have some
Well, I mean,
desire to go down the tariffs route.
Elon Musk is, pretty adamant that the bureaucracy and the government administration and the government budget, etc., needs a serious overhaul. And he's on record as saying that might cause a couple of years of short-term pain in the economy. So, I agree with you, Rodney. I mean, he's never been held to account on most of the promises that he made in his first term. But at this point in time, he's got a lot of tensions, or he's got a lot of conflicting interests that he needs to kind of weigh up. I mean, if he gives Elon Musk the full kind of freedom to do what Elon Musk is saying he's going to do, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but yeah, basically he, that means massive cuts to the budget, try and bring the budget into balance, etc. And I think if most economists will argue that that's not, yeah, that might be great for the future, but he's got 4 years, and again, he doesn't have to face the people again. So he may well see that as a way of saying, okay, go Elon, cut the budget. Let's have a couple of years of economic hardship, but this is going to be better for the future. So yeah, I mean, I think. I mean, the important thing here is he doesn't have to go for a re-election. So at the end of the day, he can do many, many things, and he can not do many things that he promised without having any real accountability for them.
But he doesn't want to leave a legacy where it flips back to the Democrats as soon as he leaves. There's something of an embittered outsider about how he campaigns, he doesn't want to see those people who might have been a bit smarter than him in the classroom and so on, that he didn't like in his youth and so on. There's something of an outsider mentality to him. Which I do wonder whether he wants his legacy to be that those people never, those well-educated, the elite, the Hillary Clinton, the whatever it happens to be, you know what I mean? That it's he never wants to see those people benefit. He wants to see those people outside the system. There's some real underlying anger at these types of people that's part of what drives him. So I do wonder whether he's not going to be so reckless as to, he'll want to be as popular the day he finishes as the day he started. And he'll not want to cede popularity to those people. And I do wonder whether in part that might be the break on some of the policies. I mean, at one point he was talking about getting rid of income tax. I don't know if you heard that one in its entirety. And it could be paid for by tariffs or some other revenue stream, but I'm pretty sure he said tariffs. So I just don't know how much. Maybe he does have tons of energy for the next phase, and I guess something I say quite often is that most politicians, when they leave office, their biggest regret's not doing more faster, and he has that opportunity now. So maybe he is going to just pursue the things he didn't do with more enthusiasm than he did the first time round, without the brakes and the sensible heads around him. I don't know. I mean, this is the most amazing thing. He's won the election. He's won it comfortably. No one's quite sure what he's actually going to do.
Look, I'd like to say that he'd be concerned about his legacy, but I don't think we saw that the last time he lost. So, he left office, inciting an insurrection. Like, it's not, I'm not sure that's what drives him, but I could be wrong.
Okay, so rather than legacy, maintaining popularity, I don't think he thought he was any less popular when he lost.
Yeah, and I don't think he'll think that he's any less popular when he
No
does
matter
all of
what
these things.
happens. Fair
Yeah, exactly.
enough.
I think he lives in a
That's
different reality than most of us do, so.
yeah, okay. Fair one. Fair one in that.
Well, I think the election itself leaves an open door for the Republicans and the pipeline of talent that will now follow Trump, right? J.D. Vance, obviously the youngest VP to be elected, was quite impressive on the campaign trail from in terms of his speeches and the way he speaks and the way he did interviews, etc. Vivek Ramaswamy, another one to watch, likely to get something in the Trump administration. Elon Musk, let's throw him in there. Who knows what will happen with him in the next sort of pipeline? I think what needs to happen now is, on the other side of the fence with the Democrats is, to your earlier point, is to have that long, hard look, debrief on themselves. I mean, when you've got Michelle Obama coming out and being much more impressive and resonating with people than the actual candidate, I think there's something inherently wrong. I think Biden has a lot to answer for, and I think the party establishment has a lot to answer for. And we've spoken about this before. When you have a look at the history of the US, there is a tendency for the country to identify itself as a, I guess a center-right country, as a somewhat conservative country when it comes to certain matters. And the Democrats have to figure out how to push through on that. And if they want an Obama-style victory on both elections that he won, they have to figure that out and have to figure that out very, very quickly. 4 years is not a very long time to be able to do that, especially when the Republicans are now coming with such a strong force, right? When you've got the Senate and the House likely, and with the turnout for Trump and the incredible Electoral College results, there's a lot of soul searching that's going to be done over the next sort of little while. I think the White House will be erratic, as Trump proven to be in terms of how he sort of runs it and how he did in his first term of presidency. I think that will continue. We've seen this movie before, right? We've already seen chapter one. Let's see where chapter two takes us. Let's end on what are you, I guess, looking forward to, either in a good way or a bad way, in sort of the next little while. What's something that is on your radar now that the election is done and dusted? Rodney, let's start with you. Obviously, in the context of US politics, of course.
So the sequel's very rarely better than the original. So let's see what happens in terms of the next administration. But at my so at, who he appoints and what they've previously positioned themselves as likely to do within their area of responsibilities, what I'm going to be interested in. Obviously RFK Jr. What job does he get? Will it actually be confirmed? And how, that is the one to watch for me, about what is he going to do around health? I mean, it could be a fantastic experiment of bad decisions. Who knows? Or maybe he just doesn't get the job in the end. I don't know. These things all remain to be seen. But yeah, who gets what job? How many of the family members get the jobs? Which family members, and what's likely to then happen or ensue as a result of that is what I'm going to be most focused on, because that'll give us an idea then of which of the policies that he's discussed or commented on during the election is he actually going to move forward with. So those are my areas of interest in the next few weeks, and I'm sure there'll be more discussion on them as we go.
I think Rodney's done a very good job of some of the areas to watch out for from a domestic point of view. So perhaps I can take the international part of it. I think it's very important to see what type of signals he's going to send to NATO, what type of assurances he's going to give to the European allies. I think it's very clear that they're nervous. And of course, what he's going to do with Ukraine, whether he's going to continue the level of support for Ukraine, one would think. That will be a major internal tension that he's going to have to deal with within his party, because there are plenty of people within his party who really want the Ukraine support to continue. I think him and JD Vance are a bit more lukewarm on it. So obviously that has a big impact on what happens with kind of the geopolitics going forward. And of course, what type of stance he takes with Bibi in Israel. I think that will define where the future of the conflict in Israel is going. You know, obviously, everybody wants to see a ceasefire. Everybody wants to see the violence, destruction ending, and, you know, taking a path to some sort of political solution, something resembling a two-state solution. But is he going, and obviously Benjamin Netanyahu couldn't be further from that type of objective. You know, is he going to pull Benjamin Netanyahu in? I don't think Biden's had much success. Is he going to pull him in and say, okay, you need to start on the path of some sort of political outcome here, enough of the war and the violence? I think there's a lot of question marks around that. So all of these things, I think, are going to have a massive impact. But I think the elephant in the room is China. You know, what type of stance is he going to take with China? I think it's clear that the stance he took in his first term could really elevate some of the tensions. I think one of the if you ask me, one of the successes of the Biden administration has been its ability to kind of restore some of those relationships with China and to try and you know, heal some of those wounds. Will he come in and completely change course and go back to a much more kind of combative or aggressive stance towards China? Again, you know, these three areas have, in my mind, a lot of questions and obviously impact global peace, geopolitical kind of stability. So, yeah, let's see what he does. A large part of that will be also to see who he appoints as his, you know, national security advisor and secretary of state, because I think that will give you a very clear indication of how he looks to deal with some of the those three kind of hot topics when it comes to global politics.
I've ruled myself out of both.
Well, I thought you might be up for RFK's job. I know you're. I'm pretty sure you know much more about public health than he does.
Well, we said it will be the greatest political drama probably ever seen, and boy, did the US election deliver that right up to the wire. Jen, thank you so much for helping us make sense of it all this week. Speak to you next. And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.